Good evening. It's your boy A400.
Oh no.
With a view different.
We're not gonna have that. Go! Yeah.
Woo! 400 Club, we bout to up. Rooftop talk real one show love. No fake vibes, just truth we speak.
Every week. We break it down, no surface talk. Critical thinking, when we walk from pain to purpose, yeah, we climb. Turn real life into a mastermind. No filters here, no highlight lies. We analyze what they disguise, from social fees to inner goals. We building kings, we molding souls.
Accept the invite. Now, here we are. Hopefully, we're good here. So if you are not able to hear me, I need you to tell me, hey, I can't hear you.
I can hear you loud and clear.
Loud and clear. That's what I want to hear. I don't know what was going on. It was kind of scary. I'm like, hey, what the hell is going on? I know my it was working great earlier today. You know, I do my little sound bites and stuff like that. So I'm like, okay, I don't want to be embarrassed. And yeah, I don't want to be a sham. That guy's a sham. I didn't want that to happen. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. I'm going to go into this and then, you know, we just take it from the top. Okay, for those just discovering your work, Sheldon, who is Sheldon Greaves beyond the author title? Can you break that down for us?
Yeah. So I found myself in a number of different places, mostly because when I finished my doctorate, I decided I didn't want to go into academia because it was just too confining and there were too many other interesting things to do. So I went out and there weren't any jobs too. So yeah, I went out and I've been trying to publish here and there on my topic, which is the ancient Near East. I did some technical writing. I told you that I had I also ended up co-founding a university for intelligence professionals. Spent some time in the nonprofit sector promoting science literacy, and along the way did some tutoring, some cybersecurity, and just generally having a lot of fun just reading the world and enjoying stuff that came my way without having to worry about going to faculty meetings.
Very impressive resume. A stunner. This man was training people. He was in the intelligence. He was like CIA and places all over the world, not just in America. And he had a university. He was partnered up with a man. He had a university too. But the part that stuck out to me the most was the CIA intelligence. I'm like, I don't know.
Job well done.
Job well done. I'm like, maybe I need to do a little more, you know, researching. And, you know, I'm about to turn that feature on that says pre-interview at this point, because maybe I would have came with something a little more different. We appreciate that with what you just gave us so far. What first pushed you towards storytelling rooted in culture, spirituality, and deeper historical narratives? Let us know about that there.
Well, you know, pretty much every culture, every society is rooted in a story, mm-hmm. you know, and we teach by stories. You know, that's how we, but it's also how we kind of sort things out, you know? So if you, you know, if you hear someone say something like, you know, a certain man walked down from Jericho and fell among thieves who beat him up and left him by the side of the road, you know, we're about to hear about, you know, the story of the Good Samaritan. And there's all kinds of lessons you can draw out of that, right?
Sounds, you know, like we get into that Hebrew Bible you was talking about, Sheldon.
That's exactly right. You know, we, you know, stories are how we build our world. You know, you wanna find out about somebody's life, you're gonna hear stories, and you know, they're not gonna give you an equation. You know, they're gonna give you a flow chart. You know. It's narrative, and that's also kind of how we process things in the world that just don't respond to numbers. You know, I mean, there are a lot, most of the things that happen to us in our life, you really can't break it down to numbers and put it on a graph or anything. You got to feel it. You got to hear it. You've got to let it kind of sink into your bones and sit there for a while and incubate until you understand it. And I find I think that was one of the things that drew me to Near Eastern studies, is because a lot of it is just, it's about the stories. It's about the stories in the parchment and in the tablets and inscribed on the wall and passed down, you know, with, you know, in oral tradition, some of which are still, right, you know, going today. So, you know,
my great granny, she was 72. I was about 5.
Uh-huh.
And she told me the identity of my people, Blackfoot Indian. And when you mention that to people, they think of the Indians that you see nowadays. So, you know, until now, before I was confused, but then now I know what's going on. Because a lot of stories are covered up for certain reasons. And I, you know, I have my own theory on things. And I'm like, okay, when I tell others, they think I'm crazy. But I'm like, I look at my granny, I look at my sisters and brothers, I look at my uncles, and we don't look like the ones that come from the Siberian peninsula. So, okay, here's a question. That I was trying to get to you last room, but you said you couldn't really hear me. Okay. Your writing often blends folklore, mysticism, and real world history. What influence shaped that unique voice? Can you walk us through that creative process, Sheldon, if you don't mind?
Yeah. Basically what it involves is me kind of pulling together stuff from as many different directions as I can. And, you know, because I'm not working in the confines of a university, I got to get creative. So I go looking, you know, for other people who might know. They may not, you know, they're probably not going to be professors, but they know stuff. There are a lot of other information sources out there that people just don't know about. You know, go to your local reference librarian and ask them, hey, tell me 5 sources of information that people don't know about. And they might stop at 10 or 11, you know, because there's just so much stuff out there. And then here's the important part. I write down as much as I can just in longhand, and then I put it aside and I let it sit. Because I discovered a long time ago that ideas, like every other living thing, they have gestation periods, they have incubation periods, and if you try to bring it out too soon, you're going to get something that's deformed or even stillborn.
Rushing the process. I got you.
You have to let it take its time and
just respect the process. That's it.
Exactly. That is the perfect description. You have to respect the process. And if you do that, you can get something pretty special. And that's one of the problems that I have today with the way a lot of creative work is done, is it's done for people who don't understand that. They say, well, we need it by tomorrow, you know, or we need it by next week. Well, sorry, this is going to take a month, you know, or longer. Now, sometimes having not quite enough time is a good thing, because it forces you to look at something and say, now, is there something I can, that isn't really necessary here, that I can get rid of,
you know? Right.
But, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, you have to work with it. You can't, you can't just beat it into submission. You know, you have to.
Yes, it takes time. It takes time. And you can't rush creativity. That's how I think about that. So do your stories come from research, personal experiences, or like something more intuitive?
Pretty much all of the above. You know, I'll take it wherever I can find it. You know, there was a guy, he was an American philosopher back in the late 20th century. His name was Eric Hoffer. Mm-hmm. And he wrote some very influential books. The interesting thing about Hoffer, though, was that he wasn't an academic. He was a dock worker in San Francisco. Mm. But he was self-educated and had read really widely. And someone asked him how he does research. And he says, okay, suppose I come to town and I'm looking for someone, and let's say he's a doctor or something like that. You know, I could go to, you know, go to a hospital and ask around, or go to, you know, a doctor's association and try to find him. That's not my method. My method is to stand on the corner of Powell and Market Street and wait for him to come by. And if, you know, if you're willing to just kind of take in the scenery and you're patient, that's as good a way as any. And if he doesn't come by, somebody else will, and it'll be fine. You know? And so I kind of like letting serendipity, you know, go unleashed and take a lot of that. I write a lot. I spend a lot of time in a notebook, and the funny thing about that is that if you do that often enough, you'll have these moments where you're writing something and it's a really good idea coming out, but it's like you're an outside observer. It's like, damn, where's that coming from? You know? And I've also learned.
I know exactly what you mean. Sometimes when I like do poems, when I was doing poems, or at a time I was writing a little book, and then I started speaking the way that, I mean, writing the way that I never thought I even had that type of creativity. So I get exactly what you're saying. Like, who the hell is this person? Like, you look on the outside. Yeah, I got you. I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the other rule is never throw away anything that you had to get up at 2 a.m. to write down. You know,
okay.
Mm-hmm. stuff that comes to you under really, really wild circumstances, man, that's usually gold. So I read a lot. I also try to read in different places. One of the things about my degree at Berkeley was that it required me to learn a number of different languages. Mm-hmm. And so I try to go to sources, you know, in their language, if it's one I can read, because the voice is real. It's more authentic, you know. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, and that was one of the things that was so great about learning to read the Bible in Hebrew, is that it's a different book, you know. I mean, there's some places in there where it's like the translations that we have, they kind of smooth it over a bit. I mean, there's a couple places, for instance, where Ezekiel, he's dropping the F-bomb, you know? It's like, whoa, boy.
All right. Okay, I want to jump into that yet. I mean, and now that I know that you said you wrote it. What did you say about the Hebrew book? You said you read the Hebrew book. So you're familiar with a lot of stories and stuff like that.
Read Hebrew Bible, yeah.
The Hebrew Bible, yes, the Hebrew Bible. Mm-hmm. With the Hebrew Bible, then you have the one that's from the Ethiopian Bible. So those are two of the same thing, right?
Well, they're the same books, different language. Ethiopic. It's basically the same books that we have in our Old Testament, plus a few others. That we don't have, and it's a somewhat different language. It's a language that's kind of like Hebrew, but maybe closer to Arabic. but it's old stuff, and it's
ancient Arabic or the Arabic they speak today.
The Arabic they speak today.
Oh, it's the same language.
It's similar. Similar.
Okay. Yeah, so then it's still ancient and modern. Okay, I got you.
What about the context? Is the context pretty different, or is it pretty much the same?
It's pretty much the same. Yeah. There's also a couple of other books that they have that we don't have. Like there's a book called The Book of Jubilees. And,
mm-hmm. I heard about that book. Yeah.
Yeah.
The book that they took out of the Bible here? Because it's by 66. Oh, shoot. Mm-hmm. I think we're going a little bit off course. So, and I want it to flow naturally, but I do have to get these questions out, right? Okay. So, this is what I need from you, because I know you're author. You wrote many books and things like that, right? What's one story or concept you have written that you feel people completely misunderstood?
Oh, wow.
I know. Let's see if you can take it.
you wasn't prepared to think that much.
that's a hell of a curveball, man. That's a good one. I think, you got me on that one. It's not so much trying to think of one; it's trying to choose which one. One of the things that I think that a lot of people that I like to write about that a lot of people misunderstand is this idea that ordinary people can do serious and even important intellectual work and actually make a contribution to society even though they're not a professor or a big pundit or anything like that, that it's possible for regular people to do serious stuff. That's the one I have the hardest time getting people to understand, which is weird, because there's lots of good examples out there. And quite frankly, I think a lot of the really smart thinking isn't happening in universities these days.
You can say that again. Nowadays, somebody said the other day in one of these podcast rooms that you have to have it. It was just early today, right, Stunner? Uh-huh. That you have to have a degree to basically
to be able program. To teach. Yeah, program. Yeah, robots.
And that's not all the way true.
No, it's not true at all. In fact, this was when we were putting together this university. One of the problems that we faced was this is the first time anyone had put together actual accredited degree programs in these fields. So we have to have faculty members, and they all have to have degrees in what they're teaching. Well, there were no degrees in what they were teaching. So we kind of had to go to the accreditors and say, look, this is our problem. How are we going to solve this? And so what we decided was everybody would prepare a portfolio, and then they would look at the portfolio and say, okay, yeah, this person's qualified, but they didn't have a degree. I mean, really, a degree is just kind of a reputation you buy off a J-hook.
Yes. Thank you for saying that. That was beautifully said. I'm not going to lie to you. And I've been telling people for a very long time. There's many of people out there that didn't have to go through the schools in mm-hmm. order to, learn. It's just that you get that recognition when you come from Harvard University or Yale or something like that. That's just what it is. And I'm glad you said that. Maybe they believe it when you say it so deeply. So.
Well, yeah. By the same token, I've had instances where, I refer to myself as Dr. Greaves, and I get taken seriously in contexts where I have absolutely no business being taken seriously. So there's that,
Okay, let me bring my brother Damien up here. Here on this podcast, here on this podcast, this is I only do it like a lot of black folks on this podcast here. Okay. And like I said, what caught my eyes when I seen that you specialize in Black identity. So before we go there, okay, a lot of your work touches on identity and history, hidden history.
Mm-hmm.
Hidden history. So, okay. How important is it for people to reconnect with their cultural roots?
Oh, it's crucial. It's absolutely vital. And I think there's a reason why, Black history is being, you know, suppressed, frankly, in a lot of our schools. Women's history, Hispanic history. And one of the reasons why, I think, is because it's not just a history of people. It's a history of their resistance, specifically successful resistance. And you don't want that being taught, you know, if you find that dangerous, right? So, knowledge is power, and knowledge can be dangerous to the wrong people or to the right people, depending on your point of view.
Right.
It's who you are. It's like I was saying before, it's all about stories. You know, we define ourselves by our stories, and I want the stories in my life to reflect who I am and where I come from.
I'm gonna be honest, right? I think you're racist, and I think you colonized us.
Wait. Doc. We're not doing that, bro. Don't bring no one up, okay? Don't bring no one up. I'm sorry about that, Sheldon. Who brought?
That's all right.
Up here?
It's my first day.
Did you bring him up here?
I don't know how he got it.
Yeah, that was my bad.
Oh no. You can't bring. I don't want you to talk to anybody on this here platform. It's controlled because we have people like that mm-hmm. that are really stupid, and then they're not professional at all.
Understood.
So just don't bring anyone up.
Okay.
People that's up here is the one that I entrust in, that are more mature, and that'll have that conversation with you. Banters okay. and everything, but on a mature level. Do you believe storytelling can correct historical narratives that may have been distorted or erased?
Oh yeah. I think history and stories, yeah, they get shifted around all the time. One of the things I used to tell people when I would teach classes on the Old Testament was history isn't the point. History is being used to make a point.
Hmm.
You know, you have a lesson, you have a concept, you have an idea or an ideal that you want to put out. And if regular straight up history will make that point, great. But, you know, in the past, there's always been a tendency to tweak it a little bit, you know, if it will serve the purpose of whatever point you're trying to make. And that's just the way we are. It's just the way humans are. We tell stories and we change them if we need to. And we sometimes make them up entirely. And you know what? That's fine. That's just how we are.
I think a lot of the history here in America amongst my people has been distorted and taken away from us too. I think slowly but surely things are being unrevealed
mm-hmm.
at this point.
Absolutely right. No question about it.
Why do you think that these stories about my people here has been distorted or taken away from us? Like you said, you worked inside. I don't think anything that you say right now is incriminating towards yourself. But if it is, you can tell me. You told me that you worked in intelligence, CIA, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You trained different. And as I know of the CIA, there's certain things that they put in place, COINTELPRO and all those things that destroy nations. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they do. They have done, some pretty nasty stuff.
Right.
And a lot of it, a lot of it is, a lot of it comes down, at least inside their walls, it comes down to what is the story? What's going on? what is so-and-so's intention? You know, on the outside, of course, they understand, as do a lot of other people, that if you control the story, you can control how people think and what they are likely to do. And that's a very powerful thing. So if you can, you know, if you can claim that those stories, claim that history for yourself and say, this is what it was and this is how it was.
Strong.
That's strong. That's powerful.
Wow. Hey, Animal, are you hearing this, bro? You hear, Damien? You there? Guess not. I know you're hearing this, Stutter.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just trying to familiarize myself with it.
Oh, he's looking you up right now. I didn't brief him on you. So you said that controlling the narrative, you control the people, you control the minds.
Yep.
Ultimately control the land.
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been a time in history when the CIA we have stolen some people's history and given it back, or that never happened?
You know, I'm sure there probably is. I wasn't privy to that kind of information. I never actually had a security clearance. I was just training. But you know, one thing I did do, I was teaching a class at one point on religious extremism. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about, about different groups and, you know, how, once again, you know, it's how people get radicalized a lot of times depends on the stories they hear.
Radicalized is crazy.
Yeah. You know, radical, the word radical comes from the word radix in Latin, which means root.
Right.
And, you know, if you're a radical, that just means you're getting back to your roots.
Right. I was going to say something really crazy, like, fuck that.
Beautifully said.
What did you say, Stana?
Me, made me think of some things that I need to be doing, but okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So listen, we're going to be right back. We're going to come back after this here messages. Listen. I don't have this is what I have to do. You can go to my profile, click on my picture, and I have all the links of the places where I am on every platform, including YouTube. And if you ever want to go on a podcast, what you can do is hit me up in the back channel. And what we'll do is we'll create an automated character for you, and we'll be having a conversation on my audio podcast. Let's go. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the top. With a view different.
Four in the club, we rise above. Rooftop talk real, one show love. No fake vibes, just truth we speak. Strong minds build every week.
We break it down, no surface talk. Critical thinking when we walk from pain.
It's gotta be happening, Dave, man.
Turn real life to a mastermind, no filters,
yo.
No highlight lies. We analyze what they disguise, from social fees to inner goals. We building kings, we molding souls.
Now we back. Welcome to the 400 Club Rooftop Talk. You got your boy Jay here. Today we're here with Shelton Grease. Hey, Shelton, this question is going to get a little crazy, okay? I'm not trying to make a crazy, a toxic environment, but some people do have questions. But I'm going to hit you with this question. Do you think there's a deliberate suppression of certain cultural or historical truths?
Yeah, and I think absolutely there is. In fact, you know, I mean, here's a good example. Look at what's been happening in Gaza. Mm. The Israeli Defense Force has
modern day. Let's take it there, Sheldon.
Yeah, they They have been targeting from the very beginning. They have targeted schools. They have targeted libraries. They basically reduced the entire university system in Gaza to rubble. You do that because you want to destroy a culture.
Mm.
And all the stories that go with that.
What culture? Let's specify specifically. Here we don't cut corners. We don't beat around a bush. We direct. You're talking about Israel and Gaza. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. You had the same thing during the Yugoslav war, where you had Serbs destroying libraries and destroying schools. During World War I, the Germans got everybody really pissed off when they went into the Belgian town of Leuven and destroyed this library that contained thousands of priceless medieval manuscripts, you know. And that just, you know, I mean, but that is just part of what happens when you want to
suppress a people.
Suppress a people. You suppress their culture and their stories because that's where
and
it
now,
is.
And now they're lost in whatever you give them, they believe. And now you control the story. That's why they call it his story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's history. The word history comes from the Greek word historia. Mm-hmm. It's almost exactly the same thing, but you know, it's the story. It's mm-hmm. it's your story, their story.
The story of the conqueror.
Yeah,
because they suppressed the other. Okay, so where should people draw the line between healthy skepticism and outright dismissal? What do you think about that?
You know, that's a really good question because, you talk about people being gullible and blanket skepticism and blanket cynicism is just another form of gullibility, really. What I think where you draw the line is you look very carefully at what you know and you develop a skill for not going beyond that. You know, so for instance, I just listened to a podcast or not a podcast. It was a little video thing by another Bible scholar that I know. He was talking about, you know, Moses. Did Moses exist? And he was saying, well, probably not, you know, for this reason. And you know, the thing is, most of what he thought was evidence was really assumptions. And I'm kind of like, no. You don't say he probably didn't exist. You say we don't have confirmation.
Hmm.
You know,
there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. So what you do is you have to be a little bit humble. You have to realize, you know, damn it, there's just a whole lot we don't know. And unless you've got, you know, some really solid stuff to go on, just don't push it. You know, be willing to not jump on the certainty, you know, bandwagon. The thing is, we're in a society where we just have to be certain about everything. And that's a trap, you know. You know, the price of certainty is you'll eventually find yourself, you know, in some kind of an absurd thing because it's better to be certain than to be right, you know. But the prize of uncertainty is really wisdom. You learn to understand, I don't always know everything. You know, right. I may act like I know everything, but I don't really know it. And that's just something to keep in mind. You know, just remind myself every morning, you know, when I sit down to work, one of the things I do is I go over in my head and I say, okay, you know what? I don't know most things, and
right.
It's not going to change by the end of the day. So just be careful, you know, don't get cocky.
Not even you just not knowing. Yes. Just be careful. Yeah. Be cocky, especially if it's something that you don't know and try to be right most of the time.
Yeah.
Right. So my thing is, what was the question that was in my head? Oh, my God, it went out so quick. Well, let's just go to this.
Sure.
What does the truth mean to you when it comes down to history and identity?
Yeah. What it means to me is that I want to, you know, I want to know who I am, and I want to know what it is that shaped me and the world I live in. And if I understand how that happened, there are two things that happen. One is the more you learn about the world and how we got here, the more you start thinking about maybe you can change things. And the other thing that happens is you start to see how change is possible. You just, you realize, you know, it hasn't been this way forever. In fact, for most of the time, it's been completely different. And when change happens, it's kind of comes out of nowhere.
Right.
You know, there's an ancient concept that the Greeks had. They called it Kairos time. And Kairos is a moment when things kind of line up in ways that they haven't been before. And what used to be impossible suddenly becomes possible. And I think we're in a Kairos moment right now. And it's going to be, you know, we're the tide is changing, and we need to follow that flood and get out and maybe, you know, inflict some goodness on the world and make a difference.
That sounds like something spiritual right now.
Yeah, it is very much so.
I see that, like I said, you told me that you specialize in, you know, reading Hebrew books and things like that, right? But then your biggest, the title, of course, is going to stand out to me. Okay, so I'm a black man, you're a white man. We got that. We know that already. Like I said, this is a black podcast. A lot of my people here are black folks. But 99%, some people, they ain't treat the land. We show them respect if they show us respect. And when it was stuck out to me the most, I said, my people would like to hear this. My audience would like to hear this. You say, it says, you specialize in black identity and spirituality. Are these, this is the question that people really want to know. And if how many people will, you know, be okay to admit it. When it comes down to these historical books, the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the characters that are played, the physical description, are they of melanated descent?
You know, the funny thing about
I know it's gonna be timeline. If I say Egypt, if I say ancient Kemet, I'm talking about from the beginning.
Oh, right. Well, okay. So if I understand your question right, you know, what does the how does the color skin color figure like historically?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, in the ancient world, skin color didn't seem to make a difference. No one seemed to care what color you were. You can look at tomb paintings, like in Egypt, you know, and where they've got all these people. They've got people every color of the rainbow, you know, in crowds next to each other. Skin color really wasn't a thing. What mattered was what nation you were from. But your skin color, you know, it wasn't. It just didn't matter.
So do you ignore the description of the Bible when they say he was dark-skinned but comely?
Yeah, I mean, it was dark-skinned, but you shouldn't infer anything from that. It doesn't really make a statement about what kind of a person they were. It just says what color they were.
Right, right. But you said that identity matters.
Yeah, the identity was basically what country you were from, but not what
you're
color.
About
you were.
Nationality. That's what you're
talking nationality. About. That's it. Yeah.
So if that doesn't matter, Yeah. Why do they have the picture of Jesus Christ that quote unquote was supposed to be Cesar Borgia, and they switched it, and now you have Putin putting out the real description of Jesus Christ, quote unquote. Why doesn't that matter? Because you did say in the beginning, you said, hey man, you take the story of someone and you control the people if you erase their history. So that's the reason why I begged that question. When I asked that question, I wanted to know, were you one of those that would tell
the truth? Yeah, can you repeat the question again? I had a little trouble hearing. It was a little fuzzy.
Oh, it was funny? Was it funny for you too, Stunner?
No, it's good for me.
Okay.
Yeah, so you might. It might be your phone.
It might be my phone. Yeah. I mean, I know my phone is supposed to be a smartphone, but it's more of a special needs phone, you know?
I just wanted you to get the description of the people of in ancient texts. You said you read the Hebrew Bible and stuff like that. I know that, you know, there was the time where there were a certain description, black.
Yeah. So
they say Jesus was black and calm. They say who's that? Jacob was black and calm. Then they have the rugged, they had the ruddy color. They have different things. I understand that people were known by nations instead of known by physical description. So I was asking you, since you were the historical the scholar, that you said that the descriptions matter. That's what you said. So I'm asking you, through your research, what were the color of those people in those Bibles?
You know, if you look at, I think if you find, you know, say a typical you know, a typical Arab, you know, darker color, dark hair. They tended to be a bit shorter than we are. Maybe about 5'5" would be average height back then. But, you know, there was someone who did a reconstruction of what Jesus might have looked like. And it was, you know, just basically kind of a Palestinian faith. I mean, he was a Palestinian Jew, for heaven's sake, you know? So yeah, dark skin, dark hair, probably a pretty good beard, would have been about, I would guess, average height. And
5 foot five.
Yeah. 5'5" was about average back then. We know that. they didn't get, they didn't have quite the same nutritional, stuff that we did, you know, that we do. So yeah, someone who was like 6'4" would have been a giant back then. So,
So Palestine before 1948.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be, that sounds right. That would be a good marker.
They show pictures about those people too. They were very beautiful. And then, you know, they show Jerusalem before they put all the different development that went on there. And so, you know, I see those people and I'm like, why is it that it's so hard for someone to give a description of a people that was there before them? It doesn't erase them. You know what I mean? Because through time, things change and change has to happen. Because nature evolves, right? What's something that you once believed strongly that you have had to rethink?
That
fell right in place, huh, Sheldon?
No, that's fair enough. I used to be a fervent believer in capitalism. That went away. That went away quite a while ago, actually. I'm not on that train anymore. I used to believe that that a lot of the things that we were doing in the world, or that most of the things that we were doing in the world were good things. I don't necessarily believe that anymore either. I think it's gotten. There was a time when we did more good things than bad things, but I'm looking, for instance, at what's happening with Iran, and I think that's just kind of an extension of a direction that we've been going for quite a while now, and it's not going to be good. It's not going to end well.
It's not. I don't think that's going to end well. They're starting up the draft, and I have a friend that wants to join right now too. He's about 35. So about that. Okay, so this is a question that I want to ask you, and I think that my co-host here would want to hear this question, right? And yourself, how can people separate knowledge from misinformation in today's information overload?
Oh my gosh! You know, I have an entire chapter on that in my book, but let me try to summarize it for you. One of the things I learned working with the intelligence community is that if you're an intelligence analyst, you have to, it's kind of like being a scholar, except you have to have always in mind the possibility that someone is trying to spoof you, someone's trying to deceive you. Well, we're all intelligence analysts now. So, you know, we're all in that boat. So what you do is you have to take control of your information sources. And what I mean by that is you have to be very picky about who you decide to listen to and who you decide to believe and what subjects you're going to believe them on. So
that's hard. That's very hard.
That's very hard because you have to choose, and they can still put you down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's some nasty rabbits at the bottom of those holes, too.
They got teeth. They got sharp teeth.
Yeah. You know, nasty, big, pointy teeth. You know? Yeah. So one of the things. So one of the things that I do is I look for sources where I know that the people who are reading those sources have money writing on whatever it is that they're reading about.
Have money writing on it.
Yeah, if you've got money writing on it, you're not going to put up with with disinformation, because you're going to end up
losing money. You can jeopardize your liability, basically.
That's right.
You can jeopardize your reputation, and then it's like, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So I also look for sources that, if they make a mistake, if they issue a correction, they say, we said this before, but we were wrong. It's actually this. Right. That's good. I look for people who are willing to say, we don't know, or I don't know, when it's appropriate to say I don't know. I also look for people who are willing to give a little background and say, okay, now before we talk about this, here's something you need to understand. And then when they get to the story, it's kind of like, oh, now I get it. You know, now I understand why this is important. So that's a good thing. I use fact-checking sites. To check facts generally, but then there's also another source that I like to use.
But what type of fact check? Because I would like to use that too, because we have a lot of debates here. I want to know
factcheck.org is a good one. Snopes is a good one. Let's see. Those are the two that I typically use. Another thing that I do, there are a couple of just for general news that I think are generally reliable. Reuters is good, AP is good. I like The Guardian. I also like The Guardian. It's a British newspaper. They actually have I like them because they kind of have this outside view that isn't colored by a lot of, you know, the crap that goes on in Washington inside the Beltway. They don't have those blinders on, so they can give you a clearer picture of what's up. There's also for Middle East stuff, Al Jazeera is actually really good. They're very accurate, which I think might be why why other countries keep trying to bomb their broadcasting station, but that's another story. And you know, between all of those, that's pretty much what I use for. Oddly enough, the Wall Street Journal, the news section is actually pretty good because, again, it's being read by people who have money writing on whatever they're reading about. The editorial page is a madhouse, though. I mean, those guys are just nuts. It's like, you know, rabid chihuahuas on a case of Red Bull. You know? So,
you and these rabbits.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so I want to talk about legacy and impact, right? Two more questions before we close this episode out. When it's all said and done, what impact do you want to work to have on what impact do you want your work to have on the next generation?
My obsession is the growth and development of an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. I want our citizens to be thinking again. I want them to be asking good questions. I want them reading, you know, good thoughts and having good thoughts and being creative. And I don't mean good thoughts like in, you know, Hallmark, you know, stuff. I mean thinking deeply about the things that go on in their lives and you know, making a difference. And that's kind of what gets me up in the morning. Working on that university was one of the highlights of my life because it was all about creating a learning community. And that's what I think we need more of. And frankly, that's one of the main reasons why I wrote the book.
Give us the shout out. Give us the name of the book again.
The name of the book is The Guerrilla Scholar's Handbook. And it's available on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Thrift Books, and a couple other places.
If your message could reach millions overnight, what's the one thing that you want people to wake up and understand, and wake up to understanding?
I want them to recapture the joy of learning something new. The best thing for being sad is to learn something. That's the only thing that never fails. No matter what happens to you, you can dispel it all by learning something you didn't know before. And that's amazing and it's powerful.
That statement just warms my heart. It really does. Right. It does.
Learning something new. Because you can put that in any area. You can put that in a relationship area. You put that into a career area. You know, I really felt that right there. No, I'm gonna give you a round of applause for that. You're supposed to give a round of applause for that. That was pretty good. Okay.
All right.
So leave us with something powerful. What's a message for people that you think that people need to hear, right? Now, well, shit. The last statement was powerful, but I'm gonna give you another chance.
you want me to top that, man? Jeez,
I don't know. This is what I had on my card, so I'm like, okay. I don't know if I give you that.
No.
Give us that statement again. At this point,
the best thing for being sad is to learn something. That's the one thing that never fails. No matter what happens to you in your life, no matter how bad you feel, if you can learn something, the excitement of learning cannot occupy the same mind with despair.
What do you think about that, Stunna? Her name is
I was just writing in the chat. You know, we were joking about this not too long ago about women, how when they go through a heartbreak, they end up going back to school to do something. And you're absolutely right. That is the best remedy for sadness, heartbreak, or failure, because it's something you can't fail at. When you gain knowledge, it's automatically a win. So you're exactly right. I just love that statement.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Make a t-shirt.
Yeah. Put that on the fridge, man. Go for it. Yeah.
So, yeah. you want to close? I want you to close it off. Go ahead, Sheldon.
Well, let's see. I really appreciate your having me on here. It's been a pleasure. And I hope that your listeners will take the opportunity to check out my book. It's basically a guide to a life of the mind and a life of learning. It's a 377-page permission slip to go out and learn something great and then change the world.
And tell us the name of that book one more time before we go.
Yes, it's called The Guerrilla Scholar's Handbook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little crazy up here, Stunner. That man.
Say that again.
Mm-hmm. The name of the book?
No, she was talking.
Yay. Yeah.
Cover me. Mm-hmm. Trying to fix up here. Okay.
Check out all platforms. 412 Rooftop Talk. Yeah. Thank you all for listening. Mr. Sheldon, we appreciate
Welcome to the
you
top.
For being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a view different.
Appreciate y'all for coming out, man.
Club, we got Rooftop Talk, real one, show love. No fake vibes, just truth we speak. Strong minds build every week. We break it down, no surface talk. Critical thinking, when we walk from pain to purpose, yeah, we climb. Turn real life into a mastermind. No filters here, no highlight lies. We analyze what they disguise. From social fees to inner goals, we building kings, we molding souls.
I think we need to have a part two here, Sheldon.